Fashion number 11883, Mr. C. E. Anson, reel 3.
Mr. Anson, reel 3.
It was a quiet time in Liverpool, fortunately for us, just before the big blitz, which would probably have cost us a lot of casualties. And I remember that we were transferred away from Liverpool to Wales, where we should originally have gone, just before the daughter, Pat Cleland's, 21st birthday, much to her sorrow. And we landed up in a charming place in South Wales called Drefach Felindre, quartered in an old woolen mill. And we used to go out on sundry pioneer corps duties there again, what had originally been intended, laying mines, laying wire, and various things. But another rather charming development was that a band and orchestra were established, because there were a lot of musical people in the company. One of our officers, Lieutenant Wood, took this in hand, begged and borrowed instruments from all over, and we established this 87th Company Band and Orchestra, who used from then on to travel about in South Wales, giving concerts and playing up for dances to mostly other military units in, well, over the whole of the western part of South Wales, which was great fun, and which was doubly agreeable for the members of this band and orchestra, because we were excused general duties and parades since we tended to be out rather late. That was run by Lieutenant Wood, but also conducted by my good friend Ken Bott, I should say Karl Walter Billmann. I stumbled over a name, and you will hear the reason for that in due course. Who had been trained as a musician and conductor, and who became my closest friend during the whole of my army days, whom I'm still very much in touch. He lives in Munich. I shall give you his address as well, because he is worth interviewing. Now, we had an idyllic summer, again with very friendly contacts with the local population, the younger element of the female population not excluded. And that took us through that glorious summer of 1941, at the end of which we were moved again to Pembroke Dock, in where we were quartered in what was laughingly called the Defensible Barracks, which was then well over 100 years old, and actually still boasted a moat and battlements, crenellated battlements, I ask you, and gun platforms with a large slate circle disc and a pillar for a spigot gun, the disc being engraved with the points of the compass, so that if Boney's ships tried to come into Milford Haven, you could send them on their way. And it felt most romantic, well, more Beaugest really than Pioneer Corps, to stand sentry on the drawbridge, which was admittedly now fixed in place and was tarmacked outside the big gates of this barrack complex, where our chief companions were a group of WAFs who clicked their teleprinters in the basement and I believe listened to enemy broadcasts. And where our, well, our companions in various meanings of that word, and the only service club in the rather derelict Pembroke Dock was the YWCA, of which we became associate members. I have my membership card for the YWCA Pembroke Dock to this very day. But it was during this time that during the very wet winter of 41-42 and the very wet summer of 42, laying mines, digging reservoirs, we became very keen on trying to transfer to other units, and there were some mysterious visitors who apparently came to size us up and to draw us out about our intentions, our motivation, our general attitude. And I remember in particular a man said to be of Swiss nationality, ordinary private, until afterwards we hear that he was really a colonel or something, I don't know how true that is, by the name of Hartmann, who lived with us, became part of us, and apparently was sent in order to size us up and to confirm our bona fides from his own experience. And he did bring this conversation round to the possibility of special units who could be dropped here and there with a screen of air attacks around them so that they could break out from that and do special tasks, to see what kind of attitude we would adopt when things like that are suggested. Well, most of us would have been only too pleased to transfer. And we tended to get writers cram filling in applications for transfer to this, that, and the other unit. And some people, especially those with an Austrian background, tended to disappear suddenly, very mysteriously, and not say anything about it. It transpires afterwards that they were probably accepted for the SOE, Special Operations Executive, for which we all had also applied, no doubt. But in my case, and that of various of my colleagues, including the above-mentioned Karl Walter Billmann, the great day came in, if I remember right, in August of 1942, when we were given a railway warrant to go to London and report to the Grand Central Hotel in the Marylebone Road, which was end of trial. And there we were put into a room and told to watch the notice board on which the orders for the day would be posted each day. The whole thing was exceedingly exciting, and you saw exciting things, people coming down corridors festooned with tropical helmets and things. And we were very, very keyed up and waiting for what might develop. And each morning, if there was nothing particular on the board, we'd go out and have ourselves a second breakfast of toast and tea and paint the town as red as we could on our meager income. But eventually the day came when we were summoned to various interviews. One of these was with a fairly slight captain, army captain, who asked us a good deal about our motivation for wanting to join a special unit. Some were with civilians, rather mysterious. One presumes they had to do with military intelligence. Again, asking about background, motivation, and intentions. And eventually, while some apparently were weeded out and suddenly disappeared back to the unit, those of us who remained were informed that a commander unit was going to be formed as part of an inter-allied commando in which we would be enlisted and given the necessary warrants to go away, have a week's leave or a fortnight's leave, and meet again at the Pioneer Corps depot at Bradford in Yorkshire. It was a very exciting time indeed, and felt like walking on air, of course. From the sublime, from the ridiculous to the sublime, from the Auxiliary Military Pioneer Corps to a most elite unit. We were even then told to keep this very confidential, and obviously it was a matter of high security. And when we assembled at Bradford with various other people from other units, we had to wait a certain amount of time before arrangements were completed. There must have been various delays, and we were quartered in some billets in Bradford and went off to parades or working parties in a rather perfunctory manner. I'm afraid we didn't behave awfully well because we were very excited, we were young and we were very high-spirited, and we were aware of what others weren't supposed to be aware, that we were no longer really Pioneer Corps personnel. And so I'm afraid we rather took advantage of our knowledge that we were a bit beyond reach of their normal disciplinary sanctions. As a result, I think we became a little bit of a handful and were eventually banished to a mill out on the moors, which was absolutely ravishing countryside, and under the charge of a disciplinarian sergeant major, who again found that the sanctions he would normally apply somehow didn't seem to make much of an impression on us. There were other sort of scandalous times when everybody was out and trickled in at any particular time they chose, giving their names to the sentries. And in the morning there would be a parade at which people would be put on charge, and the roll of the defaulters' names would range from Napoleon Bonaparte to well-known Austrian folk heroes and so on, who did not happen to be part of our little group. But in due course, the captain came back, turned out to be Captain Brian Hilton Jones, who was going to form our troop, with a stack of pay books, and said, right, come into this side room one by one, we'll fill in your new pay books, and think of your new names, because it's been decided that for security reasons, you will all have English names. And the other thing, which was arranged for security reasons, was to entrust reliable British friends with being our liaison with our previous life and people who knew us under the old names. And that was rather a clever thing to do, because the alternative might have been to pretend that we'd all been killed in the train crash and put us into some camp behind barbed wire in the north of Scotland, and it would have reeked of mystery so much that anybody who really wanted to find out about it would have made it their business to. But as it was, we each picked a reliable English family who became our next of kin. And in my case, of course, that was the Clelands of Liverpool. And the way that worked was that they would, in effect, become the post office or intermediary. Anyone who wrote to me would write to my old name at their address. They would put it into a new envelope with my new name and army post office number and send it on. And likewise, my correspondence to my relations or old friends, well, my only relation was my sister in America, would go via Liverpool, where it would again be put into an envelope with the old name as a sender. It worked very well. I don't believe that that security ever broke down. It was a very simple but very competent way of dealing with this question, which could have been made into an enormous mystery. My name was a bit of a difficulty because there were various other people whose name began with A, and there was a tendency to pick a name in which both your surname and your Christian name would have the same initials in case of embroidered handkerchiefs or what have you. And Andrews and Anderson, all the obvious A's had already gone. But at that moment, an Avro Anson happened to fly overhead, and it struck me as a very short and agreeable name and a not very common name, so at that moment I became Anson, and the Klaus in my original name became Colin. The middle name of Edward is purely on the spur of the moment, because Captain Hilton Jones looked up and said, no middle name, it's usual to have a middle name, so I simply picked that out of fresh air, and that is how Klaus Leopold Octavio Usher was made into Colin Edward Anson. It can't have been long hereafter that we all piled into a train for the cross-country journey to Wales, where we went to Aberdovey, our base, where we were going to be in private billets. The Inter-Allied Commando Number 10 was strung out along the whole of the coast of North Wales, of North West Wales, from Aberdovey, which was the billet of Number 3 Troop, with each troop in a different small town, the headquarters of the commando being at Achnacarry, Harlech, up to the northernmost, I believe, the French troop, who were stationed at Crickieth. And it was one of our perquisites, if you like, that we, instead of being in billets or camps, we were in private billets. And it was almost, in a way, like a civilian existence, in which you got a subsistence allowance, occupied the accommodation which holidaymakers would have had in peacetime, and reported for your parades as and when required. However, our first posting was to Achnacarry, which I just inadvertently mentioned, the Commando Troop, which must have been about October, November of 1942 for our basic training, which was quite demanding, which was probably intentionally off-putting in some ways in order to weed out those whose heart wasn't really in it, but which was also very cleverly designed in a step-by-step progress to get us, to extend us always a little further beyond what we thought we might be able to do, so that if you realized that you had managed this particular task or test, which you never thought you would do, then you might as well have a go at the next one. And so we're brought up to a peak of fitness and training, which in retrospect was quite astonishing to us, and in that, having passed this particular training course with the last big scheme on half rations in freezing conditions for a day or two at the very end, we were passed out and got onto the train back to Aberdovey, where eventually we were issued with our green berets and felt very grand, and carried on from that particular standard, which was, I think, very cleverly and effectively planned in a methodical way to keep us at a certain peak of performance, so that even if you only perhaps were going to have an intelligence lecture or compass reading practice, map reading or what have you, you'd first double up a mountain in order to do it, and then double down again and round the other side when you had finished. So we were brought up to and kept at a certain stage of fitness, and it was remarkable that it wasn't perhaps the most muscle-bound and loud-mouthed individuals who pretended to be very tough, but the average fellow who was reasonably fit in the first place, reasonably healthy, who could be brought up and kept at that particular level. And the training obviously was very interesting. Many other people who've said more informative things about it, but ours was perhaps more angled towards the intelligence side, and obviously bearing in mind the fact that we were German speakers, apart from some odd exceptions who slipped in because they were of German parentage, although they didn't speak a word of German, intended not so much to be used as a unit in action, but rather to be split up into individuals or groups to be attached to other units, to other commando units, when they went into action. And that was how the rest of the winter and spring of 1942-43 was employed, with expeditions to North Wales, the Snowdonia area, for mountain climbing training, rock climbing training, to the south coast, HMS Warsash, a place called Warsash, HMS Tormentor, a naval shore establishment where to undergo boating training on landing craft of various types. And the troop also underwent parachute training later on, but I was then no longer with them. I was detached. It must have been about May of 1943 to be attached to Number 40 Marine Commando, and specifically to a troop of Number 40 under the command of Captain Ephraims, and joined them during a period they were Troon and Irvine along the northwest Scottish coast for boating training during an exceedingly wet time when, during our landing craft exercises on the enormous beaches of that area, more water sometimes seemed to come from on high than from underneath. And I stayed with them until we embarked in the Clyde in a convoy which was going to take us overseas and into action. Nobody knew what and where.
Excuse me, so you were attached to 40 Commando because you were a German speaker?
That's right, yes. With three others. Miles, Stephen, I'm sorry, I even forget their names now. My memory ain't what it used to be, and it never really was very good. Perhaps there are records in which these things can be checked a little more reliably. This little group of us was attached to Number 40, which embarked on a troop ship, or rather a bivvy liner, called the Devonshire, which had been converted into a troop ship about the end of May of 1943 at Greenock. And there was a lot of to-ing and fro-ing, and we were disembarked again and then embarked once more and then told to stay below decks and not wear our green berets so it couldn't be observed from the shore, etc. and so on. And a great guessing game about what it might be, where we might go, and all sorts of suggestions were discussed, like Bordeaux or the southern French coast or whatever, until Tropical Kit came on board, and then I said, aha, this is a ruse for security purposes, we are no doubt going to Norway. And when we eventually left, it was rather impressive, a convoy of ships passing out through the Clyde with pipers playing, all very emotive, and we kept a westerly course for quite a long time. Must have been fairly close to America before turning south and then turning east again, and it was during the latter part that Brigadier Laycock called us together and informed us that we were on our way to what was up till then the biggest combined operation of all times, which was the invasion of Sicily, passing through the Straits of Gibraltar at night with everything in darkness except the brilliant lights of Tangier over on the right, and then starting to perform a large circle in the Bay of Tunis, joining more and more ships until on the day before the actual landings, we joined a vast armada stretching apparently from horizon to horizon in rather deteriorating weather, making our way towards the, in our case, the southeastern corner of Sicily at the near Pacino, the Capo Passero. And by the time we were actually to embark in the landing craft, the weather had worsened considerably and there was quite a gale with enormous seas. The Devonshire had been equipped with the modern electric derricks and landing craft, which you could swing outboard, board at deck level instead of having to clamber down nets, and lower away, fully loaded, cast off and be on our way. And it was a most dramatic journey because the sea was really very, very rough indeed, and it looked at times as though we were in danger of going over altogether. But as we came in shore, and possibly in the lee of the actual Cape Passero, suddenly the sea went as quiet as a mill pond. I've never seen such a transition in my life. And at the same time, you could suddenly hear the noise of the cicadas in the warm tropical night of warm subtropical vegetation rolling out over the sea. And the landing itself was comparatively harmless. There was fire from Italian pillboxes using tracer so that we could see where they were, but they couldn't really see us very much in the dark. And so far as I'm informed, we only lost one person killed during this quite considerable landing. I'm afraid the Italians lost considerably more people because they had, for reasons best known to them, disguised their pillboxes as hayricks, piling a great deal of hay on, and still had those little phosphorus grenades. I forget the number, but there were an offensive grenade which you could actually throw while on foot without yourself taking cover, which set the hayrick camouflage alight instantly. And I'm afraid that was the end of the Italian defenders in that area. We had been rather concerned that there were German units with Tiger tanks in the vicinity, but apparently they had withdrawn because they didn't think that on a night like that anybody would dream of landing. Or so it was said. And we split into three groups, one going inland, two going either side along the coast mopping up defences, and then withdrew again onto a perimeter made to protect the other main forces landing, which included Canadian units and a Canadian field hospital, which became our sort of central information point as well. A strenuous time, a very lively time. There was more opposition later. We were opposed by it.